Hello, everyone. I'm Viviana Young, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for Umpqua Watersheds through United Communities AmeriCorps, and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Molalla, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment, which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement.
So today with us, we have Daniel Kalki. Daniel, would you like to introduce yourself really quick?
Yeah, of course. First off, I'm Daniel. I'm really happy to be here. I'm an AmeriCorps member serving at Alder Creek Community Forest. I am the environmental educator and volunteer coordinator there. And yeah, excited to talk today.
Well, it's great to hear from another AmeriCorps member. So I hear that you did your thesis on energy policy. Could you tell us a little bit about maybe where you went to college, what you majored in, what you minored in, and some of your experiences with your thesis?
Yeah, so I went to school at the University of Mary Washington. It's a fairly small school about an hour south of DC in Fredericksburg, Virginia. I majored in political science and I minored in security and conflict studies. So yeah, bit fun stuff to be doing for someone who is now an environmental educator. But yeah, so I wrote my thesis, and my thesis was about creating a sustainable energy system and the impacts of energy security. That was the title of my thesis. And it was just my whole idea of how 21-year-old kid would want to change the global energy market. So I guess, yeah, that's what I wrote about.
So just to clear up some things, could you describe what energy policy is, and maybe while you're at it, what energy security is?
So energy policy is pretty much how a state or country addresses issues of energy development, including energy conversion, distribution, and use. Anything energy related and how they power day-to-day activities within themselves, that's the policy that goes into it. Energy security. So I guess before that, it'd be smart to talk about security as a whole, to understand the concept of what security and national security is, right? You think that'd be a good starting point?
Yes, that would be a great starting point.
Yeah. So a lot of the research I've done is based off IR theory. And I know it's important in IR theory. Terms and theories, they should not, and they aren't concrete. They should be malleable. They should change with the time as people change, as we've seen. So like, for example, in the 1970s and 1980s, security was mostly about including economics, global development. But into the 90s, there came sort of this threat that required resource, environmental, and further demographic issues. So we've seen the definition of security and national security shift over time. So with that in mind, if this definition of security is so elusive and malleable, then operating within its coverage, operating within the realm of energy security would be fluid as well. I think that's a good starting point to go from there. So for national security as a whole, I believe a good definition to go off on would just be protecting your institutions, protecting your people, your principles and infrastructure, anything that's associated with your society. So with that in mind, energy security is, it's the uninterrupted availability of energy sources at an affordable price. That is the current definition of energy security. So to give an example, if the US is completely able to supply its own energy sources, they would have incredibly high energy security. Or if they are able to get most of their energy resources from, say, Canada, a very close ally, their energy security would also be very high. But if their energy sources weren't as readily available, prices for some reason went high, or if they were reliant on say a country like Russia for these resources, their energy security would be much lower because of these different components that they wouldn't be so sure about. So added into this idea of sustainability, I thought that this definition of energy security could be a bit outdated. And I wanted to pose the argument that it should be refreshed to better describe our current global landscape on an energy platform environmentally. I wanted to add that there should be an uninterrupted availability of the energy source at an affordable price with as minimum consequential risk as well, and so that it doesn't hurt the environment. I feel like that, or I know that should be part of it. So that was my argument of how to update the definition of energy security.
And just to bring it back to some modern political problems, as I understand it, we get our oil from other countries, not all of it, but most of it. And our gas price problem is also sort of tied to our getting resources from other countries. Is that what you've observed or what you would say?
So I think that's a misconception about this particular area. So the United States right now, as it currently stands, we produce about as much energy as we consume. So we are grand producers as of late. And I know domestic oil production is at an all-time record high. So it isn't necessarily that we are directly reliant on others, but the global oil community and the global energy landscape is so interconnected that the US is going to feel the aftermath and ripples of anything that is going on. So US gasoline consumers will always be hit hard when the global price of oil shifts upward or downward. We're always going to feel that ripple effect, as we are right now.
I see. So you mentioned that we should probably start using things that are better for the environment, such as renewable as opposed to non-renewable energy. Could you give some examples and maybe a description of renewable versus non-renewable energy?
Yeah, so some of the stuff we currently use that are the largest contributors to our energy portfolio would be the classic fossil fuels, crude oil and coal, coal being one of the largest ones, not necessarily with the US, but on a global landscape. Anything that is from something that was living a while ago and has long been dead, that can be considered a fossil fuel. Under renewables, it would be hydropower is a big one, solar power, wind power, geothermal, nuclear in some aspects, but that is a bit hazy, I know. So yeah, all of those would be renewable.
So you mentioned water power or hydropower. I've heard the term hydro drought. What is that?
So yeah, with a hydro drought, essentially if a country or state is theoretically fully hydropowered, all their chips are in one basket. And if they were to incur some way, a cutoff of that resource, it would be extremely detrimental to them, their security, their energy resource, everything. So this is what states should be doing going forward, looking into a more clean energy landscape, is to diversifying their energy portfolios so that depending on where they are geographically, they can create a landscape that is as secure as possible.
So as you just said, it is important to diversify, but also keep in mind terrain and weather. Those two things do have a great impact. For example, the US and Panama might not be the same. Could you discuss that and maybe discuss how those differences might appear across different countries?
Yeah, so it's not cookie cutter. So one of the ideas I wanted to put in is the idea that countries could theoretically develop their own formula, their own definition of the sustainable energy system. And I don't have that definition for every single country or really any country. It would be up to the individual states to decide based off their own characteristics, their population, their economy, the geographic location, the resources they have at hand. It'd be incredibly unfair and unrealistic to put the United States and Panama on the same field and expect them to have similar landscapes on that respect. The Panama has population, I think it's around 4 million. We're in Oregon right now. Oregon is around 4 million. So the scalability is very great. Yeah, so also with geography, where these countries are located, the effects of climate change can have diversifying effects as well. Most countries, almost all countries, are going to face the impacts from it. But countries like Panama that are in warmer environments, coastal bound, will find greater impacts from this. So they will look to try and create portfolios that address this as such.
So what would you say? I'm not sure if you've done a lot of research on it, but what would you suggest just hypothetically for Oregon as the best renewable resource that we may use?
For Oregon itself?
Yes.
So I haven't done too much research on Oregon itself or this in particular, but I think what would help would be look at yourself in an individual standpoint and seeing what you can do, your day-to-day actions. Say you work a mile away. Wouldn't hurt to walk that day. You don't have to drive every single day. But at the end of the day, also, it's important to note that bottom-up policy is very difficult, and the impact of starting from the bottom, getting to the top, is unlikely to occur. I think what's most important going forward is for the policymakers and the leadership we have at the top level are influential and put policy going forward that will lead this cause.
During the course of your research and your work, did any of your perspectives change? Did you gain any new understandings that you may have had misconceptions about before?
Yeah, as many people are going into school, you don't really know what you want to do. I still don't know what I want to do. My dad's 63. He tells me still he doesn't know what he wants to be when he grows up. So I knew I wanted to read. I knew I wanted to write. And I like to talk. So I ended up taking a few classes, intro to international relations, intro to political science. And I was captivated on the idea that for these global problems, for these national problems, there isn't a specific solution that will work 100% of the time. But from my perspective, I truly think that everyone deserves a chance. And I think at the end of the day, people are good and they want to help each other and the environment around them. And I think the way that governance is set up right now is not in the way that it should be.
So why would you say that this research is so important?
I think this research is important. I have the understanding that it's not going to have immediate impact, but I know it's imperative going forward. Our current global energy landscape is one that needs to be addressed. And I think there are disparities in this landscape that are staggering. And if they aren't addressed, they will be continually problematic in the future. One of these disparities being the gap for the promise for energy for all, everyone having energy on the planet. But there's still about 1 billion people that don't have electricity today. They don't have access to electricity. And that is crazy. 1 billion people, I think mostly in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, hundreds and millions more with unreliable power. And from a humanitarian standpoint, that is not good, obviously, but also from a security standpoint, that is a barrier to economic development, security, health, education, and equality. And where we're at with our current energy landscape, it clearly isn't a promising solution. So something needs to change in that aspect. And I think this research backs that up. I think another disparity and another gap would be scientific evidence continuing to prompt the need for incredibly fast reduction in greenhouse gas emission, and the data showing that CO2 emissions are continuing to hit a historic high. I think it was 2018 where we hit a historic high of like nearly 2% increase from the year before. That is so high. This is driven by higher energy consumption. Our global economy has been booming recently, and the demand for energy is going up for heating and cooling as our temperatures are hotter and colder. And so with this, there's a correlation between fossil fuel usage and rising temps. The more we continue to use these fossil fuels to fuel our energy systems to combat hotter and colder weather, the hotter and colder the weather will become. The IEA, it's the International Energy Agency. They're a very big organization that does research and puts out reports on all of the energy usage globally. They came out and found that coal, one of the biggest users globally, energy-wise, coal itself is one-third responsible for global surface energy temperature increases. That is one resource that is just almost has exactly a third of the responsibility for raising the temperature on the planet. I think a lot of the research nowadays is on climate change and what it is and the impact it can have. But I think not much of the discussion, I think more of the discussion should be based on, is the correlation between climate change and energy security. I think a lot of nations nowadays will be more prompted to focus on climate change and the effects it can have if they have the understanding of the impacts it has on their own national security.
And do you have any advice for maybe individuals who would be interested in lowering their carbon footprint or using energy in a more sustainable way?
Yeah, so from a grand scale, individually, it's not going to have that much of an impact, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. You should recycle. You shouldn't just throw everything away. You obviously shouldn't dump into random places in the rivers and stuff. And I just think it's being conscientious of your actions and decisions. Walk when you can, don't always just drive. And I think look to your local community and what meetings and resources you have, you can go to be an active community member in that respect. And then try and push policy forward in your local community. I think that is going out and trying to push policy and having influence on that end is the biggest thing people can do.
So globally, what does current energy supply and demand look like, would you say?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think at present, energy demand where we're at right now, our populations keep on increasing. Energy demand may eventually outpace energy supply. So we might not always be able to supply all the energy that we need. And as right now, energy demand is currently outpacing decarbonization. So those are two things we need to focus on. Our current dependency and usage of these fuel sources, fossil fuels, have increased dramatically over the course of time. And this has only brought up problems threatening other areas of security. They've brought out resource constraints, climate change, environmental pollution, all of which severely threaten human health and development. Like I said before, I don't think government leaders have taken into account in their decisions in energy policy the impact it holds on all aspects of security. And that's one of the things I really want to hammer home. I think globally and nationally, we need to better address security needs and what it is, and that governments should seek to widen their conceptions of security. Security nowadays isn't sending a guy's a battalion out with guns. That's not what security is. It's not what it looks like anymore. It's important. It's a thing, but you need to expand it to include human security, primarily over the concerns the role sustainability and environmental degradation have on people. Because at the end of the day, if we continue down the route we are right now, climate change will have a negative impact on national security or on states.
So what sorts of locations or regions did you look at during your studies?
Yeah, so as I said before, one of my key principles was understanding that each nation, each state would be able to develop its own definition of a sustainable energy system. So with that in mind, I wanted to run case studies, theoretical case studies, on different states based off varying criteria that they would be able to establish their own definition. I looked at Panama, I looked at Switzerland, and I looked at Indonesia. Obviously, they're all different geographically. They're all very different economically, culturally. And yeah, so I wanted to dissect them where they are at currently in their current landscape. And if they have shown promise to pursue clean energy policy and what promise they can show.
So despite having similar resources, did they have any major differences? Why exactly did you pick these three countries for your case studies?
Yeah. So I know right off the bat, Panama and Switzerland. Panama is, resource-wise, is almost as good as it gets for renewable energy. They have solar power. So where they are located geographically, the energy they retain through solar means is very strong efficiency-wise. I don't have the numbers right now, but they geographically are very well suited for solar energy. Hydropower, the Panama Canal can be great. They have begun to use it. And wind power, they can use quite a bit. But the big difference between the two of them is how they've established the means to go about with clean energy policy. Switzerland is much further down the line, being a much more well-developed, higher GDP per capita country than Panama is. So this goes back to, you can't have cookie cutter definition for this, because it wouldn't be fair to put Panama on the same playing field of expectations as Switzerland.
And all three of these countries do have very different cultures. In your opinion, does culture affect things like this?
Yeah, I think, of course. Even right now, globally, we have the technology to go fully renewable. A lot of it, what's holding back is the policy, is the integration. So on that end, it's not fully possible. And then the policies and what goes on in these countries can also seep into cultural aspects a lot. Because Switzerland, it is a very developed, I wouldn't say it's so much more developed, but economically it's more stable than the other two. They're able to focus much more on pushing towards a clean energy system. I know one of the biggest problems Switzerland has faced, I think 2/3 of their energy used in recent years has been renewable, which is incredible. They have been on the forefront of renewable energy and they continue to do so. But one of the things that is holding them back and that they will have to learn to adjust to over time is policy disagreements and opposition to clean energy policy. Obviously, one of the biggest things nationally that are going to hold countries back is political opposition to this clean energy policy and how it could be negative or just opposition in general. There's always going to be opposition. They've been having to deal with that. But another one is disagreements within advocates for clean energy policy and how that policy should be implemented. So it's overcoming these domestic issues to further their agenda.
Let's say also on sort of a cultural level, economics do play a bigger role for the individual. So for example, I know that a lot of people, at least here in the US, have a bit of a problem using things like electric cars, for example, because they're not entirely affordable. Do you think that it's a reasonable outlook to say that we might make these things more affordable, or do you think that that's far away in the future?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this when considering all the gas prices right now. And people have to buy gas no matter what currently. If you're going to go to work, you're going to pay $2 for gas. If it's $2, you're going to pay $6.50 for gas if it's $6.50. Not everyone has the luxury of walking. So what the government can do, and I think that would be or could be a benefit, is try and develop smarter investments to accelerate clean energy development. Clean energy is our cheapest form of energy, and this would increase our energy security going forward if we had more infrastructure around it. I also think along the lines of EV, I think expanding EV tax credits would greatly help. Overall, I think even expanding tax credits would lower demand on oil. If people are getting more money back for driving and owning EVs, then the demand of oil would go down and thus prices will drop. Even if it's very small, it would have an impact.
So what do you think sustainable energy would look like? How could success be measured?
I think sustainability, this type of system, must meet the needs of the present without interfering and negatively compromising the needs of future generations. Yeah, I think it's irresponsible to be selfish thinking there aren't going to be people after us and that it should be our responsibility. It is our responsibility to try and create and develop a system that will not only reward ourselves, but look to help those in future generations. I think, like, along the lines of individual definition for country, success would also be very variable. So you'd have a country like Panama, if they are able to create policies. I know they have a policy in place where they'll look to further develop energy until 2050. That could be measured as success. A country as Switzerland having 2/3 of its energy consumption being renewable energy could be measured as success. Measuring success from a grand scale, I don't think would be as beneficial as each country looking at their own criteria and judging it based off that.
So you would say that setting goals is very important for individual countries?
Yes.
And how might someone find your work? Do you have any contact information?
Yeah, I can provide my email if that would work.
That will work.
Danny, D-A-N-N-Y, Kelke, K-A-L-K-E, 31 at gmail.com.
And do you have any general advice for people looking to study a similar topic?
Yeah, I think just go into what you think you're passionate about and just read as much as you can. Ask as many questions to your professors, to people you know, and just dive into stuff you have no idea about. I think just explore and don't be afraid to ask questions. I think this is a field that doesn't really have any right answers right now. And I don't think we're going to find answers for a little bit. But I think that's why it's such an interesting field to look into, because of how many ideas there are around it.
How did you get involved in this topic specifically?
So with my minor, security and conflict studies, I had to write my thesis based off of something related to national security. And I know most of the themes around these papers are based off certain wars, certain battles that impacted the direct theme of national security. And I wanted to explore a different route. I've always been interested in environmentalism and conservation. And like I said prior, I think a lot of the definitions that have been used should be updated and should be more malleable to how the current landscape globally looks. I think the connectivity between all the aspects of security is fascinating, especially the environmental side of how rising temperature and impact on a reef in Australia can have negative national security impacts there. I just think that's fascinating. And I think it would be really cool going forward for governments and states to have more attention to this, to involve the changing climate and weather conditions and energy security in their national security decisions.
And finally, were there any notable people who helped you through your research and college experience?
Yes. Number one, first and foremost, would be Dr. Jack Kramer. He was my professor of political science and international affairs at University of Mary Washington, now retired, deservingly so. He was excellent, and he was my advisor for this project. Yeah, and I wouldn't have been able to do this without him. He probably wouldn't agree, but he was and is incredible.
And moving on a little, you mentioned that you work at Alder Creek. Where is Alder Creek, and what is Alder Creek, the organization?
Yeah, so Alder Creek is a non-for-profit environmental forest located in Canyonville. It's about 80 acres of land and trails and forest that we want to use to help the community extend themselves to their local environment and give educational opportunities for them to have a better understanding of their outside world.
So what are you currently doing there? What is your role?
So I'm the environmental educator and volunteer coordinator. So with the volunteer coordination, I'm looking to help develop our volunteer program there, getting people in, helping with projects, getting feedback, how they think we can assist them and stuff like that. But on a daily basis, as an environmental educator, I'm looking primarily to help provide contact to the community onto different environmental aspects of the site that we can offer to them to give them better insight to their environment.
And now for some brief announcements.
Coming up on April 9th, Umpqua Watersheds will be hosting an invasive plant removal at Wright Creek. Starting at 9 a.m. and going until 3 p.m., volunteers can break at 12 for lunch. We will be meeting at the library parking lot and following in our cars to the site. Bring full-length pants and a light jacket if needed. Gloves and tools will be provided. If you have any questions or would like to express interest, email Spencer Dietrich at spencer@umpquawatersheds.org. That's spencer@umpquawatersheds.org.
We at Umpqua Watersheds are excited to announce our upcoming banquet on April 10th from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. While we will not have an auction this year, we will enjoy food from our local sources, presentations from our committees highlighting our work, and a keynote speech by community dynamo Juliet Palencius. The banquet will be outside behind our building, and we will have awnings and heaters if necessary. Our outback stage will be covered, and we will have live music from 4 to 5 p.m. during happy hour. If you love to read and would like to discuss environmental topics with fellow bookworms, try Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club. Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club meets over Zoom every other month and will next meet on Saturday, May 28th. The book to be discussed will be Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest by Suzanne Simard. All sessions take place virtually at 5 p.m. on their date. For more information, please email Umpqua Watersheds Director of Education and Outreach, Ryan Kincaid, at her email, ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. That's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Or, if you'd like to share your environmental knowledge with the community by being interviewed for an episode of Living Downstream, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. That's viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. So, does Alder Creek have any interesting events coming up that you'd like to share with us?
There are some pretty cool things we have planned for Alder Creek in the near future. First of all, next Saturday, April 9th, we're actually hosting a garden day. So at our site, we're currently in the process of developing our own orchard and garden. We're really excited about that. We want to get a lot of native trees and native plants in there and really just express the outdoor environment we have going for us. So this day in particular, we'll be hosting volunteers from 10 a.m. to around 2 p.m. or until whenever you want to go. We'll just be excited to have people. We'll be working on laying tarp and mulch around our newly tilled beds and possibly adding chicken wire around the orchard to protect these young trees from hungry deer that want to eat the tasty buds as a nice snack. So if anyone that's listening is available and isn't going to the Watersheds Volunteer Day that day, Alder Creek, we'd love to have you and would really appreciate your help with this really cool project. So if you are interested and want to learn more, you can contact me at my email.
So another interesting development we also have in the works at Alder Creek is that we're looking to actually host some mycologists in the near future, which we're really excited about that. I have no idea about mushrooms, and just from a selfish point of view, I think it's going to be really cool to have people like this on site to teach me and other people about this really cool topic. So we're really excited to work with Zoom Out Mycology. That's a mushroom farm out of Central Point, Oregon. So we've actually had a meeting with them earlier this week and just laying the foundation with what we want to get done, what we want to target education-wise, and what we think will be best suited to the community in this partnership. So our plan is to have some of their members from Zoom Out's team lead an educational hike of some sort that we'll plan out through our trail system. And they'll be able to examine the different fungi and environments Alder Creek has to offer. I think it'd be pretty cool to go through the different flora systems we have and see what fungi is growing there and what fungi could grow there and why it grows there based off what type of plants are there. We've also worked with them in the past. They've built, I think, 3 shiitake inoculation logs on site, which are all really cool. So we will go there with community members and examine those logs and look at the progress they have made since, I think it was about last winter, they've been put up. So we'll be able to look at the progress they've made and maybe even compare those inoculation logs to the growing that occurs naturally. That's not human assisted. I think that'd be a pretty cool thing to do. I know we also talked about having something afterwards, like having some mushroom-based tea and some of the stuff they can provide, which I'm excited for. I didn't know you can make tea out of mushrooms. Apparently, there's a lot of cool stuff you can do with it. And yeah, I guess I'm pretty excited to learn and hear from some of these people. They're cool. So yeah, I'm really excited to work with them. So continuing on that note, along with Zoom Out Mycology, in the coming months at Alder Creek, we're really looking to host some more interesting groups and people and different educational outdoor environmental topics and stuff like that. We actually have some pretty awesome stuff in the works, and we're excited to have more clarified announcements once we get stuff set in stone. So if you're a curious person, you're interested in environmental education, and even if you just want to learn more about the outdoor world in Southern Oregon, I would highly recommend giving us a follow on social media. From the critters we capture on the trail cameras, I know we've recently had some deer that always go to the same spot, this one squirrel that sits on a stump and eats a nut every morning, even some skunks, some foxes, some pretty cool stuff. We post the beautiful landscape and mountains and all the different blossoming and flowering plants that are coming up in spring, to even just updates and news on our upcoming volunteer and education days. That's about the kind of stuff we post. I think it's a pretty cool follow, if I do say so myself. We're Alder Creek Community Forest on Instagram, all lowercase, no spaces. Again, that's Alder Creek Community Forest on Instagram.
And how did you get involved with AmeriCorps?
Yeah, so this tags along to the research I've done. I'm really into environmental and energy policy, and I just wanted to get more involved, boots on the ground and getting connected into people. I think one of the biggest things we can do is just educate people onto environmental topics. So I know AmeriCorps is a great opportunity for this type of field as a starting point. So yeah, I found it by doing research on that.
And why did you get involved with AmeriCorps?
I wanted to explore something new. I'm originally from Rochester, New York. It's right on Lake Ontario. And I wanted to go and try something new. I've lived abroad before. I lived away for school. And I like the opportunity to explore a new place and have an impact on a community that I don't really know. AmeriCorps is a great opportunity for that.
Your other path was going to be the Navy, is that correct?
Yeah.
So why did you choose it over the Navy? What perks are there to being an AmeriCorps member that you resonated with a little bit better?
I don't know if it was specifically being an AmeriCorps member, that resonated with me as much as it's the what I'm doing and what I want to do in the future. I want to work on environmental policy and contribute to conservation efforts and just working on creating ideas that I've shared prior. And I think this was a better path for me in doing that.
So do you have any notable experiences so far with the work?
Yeah, so one of the biggest things I'm working on right now, first of all, I'd like to say Alder Creek has given me a lot of freedom in trying to improve the site and addressing like different systems and stuff. So one of the things I'm working on right now is redeveloping the trail cam system at Alder Creek and creating a database for different species there. So eventually, I don't know if I'll be able to get this done in my time, but I'd like to develop an interactive species database that the community can use to create a better interaction through the site and them.
What does your average workday look like?
Yeah, so my average workday is probably split into two parts. One part is at home working on my computer at the desk I'm at right now, going over trail cam files, going over different reports, typing in proposals we need for the site to the board, reaching out to people for volunteer coordination, or reaching out to local experts in environmental fields, just trying to get the word out there and doing computer work. The second half of my job, which I personally like a lot more, is on-site work at the community forest. Last time we were there, we were helping deer-proof our orchard. We have a lot of young trees there that are likely going to be very yummy deer snacks in the coming weeks. So we're having to put chicken wire fence up there and trying to figure out how much chicken wire we need to put around each one so the deer can't get it. And then getting the garden tended and just day-to-day maintenance of the site I enjoy. Yeah, I think one of my favorite things about Alder Creek is when I step foot there, it's no matter what day it is, I see something new. And it's an adventure each time. Even if we're walking through the trails to go and set up a new camera, seeing something new, whether it's a pileated woodpecker drumming on a tree to try and attract a mate, or it's a varied thrush doing a little dance, it's cool. I really like just seeing something new every day, watching new flowers bloom in the spring. It's a cool place, and I'm thankful I'm there.
Do you have any interesting stories?
So last time I was at the site, like I said, I'm trying to incorporate a species database. And to do that, I need to get an idea of what species are there. So one of them, I'm trying to create a bird species database. And positive thing about birds, they're everywhere. Negative thing about birds, you can't necessarily catch them too often on trail cams because you can't put them too high up the trees. Solution, we do bird counts. I'll sit out in the field in an area and set a timer, 30 minutes minimum, usually an hour. And I'll just sit with my binoculars and whatever bird I see, I'll try my best to identify it and I'll mark it down. And last time I was out there, I was able to hear the drumming of a pileated woodpecker. If you don't know what a pileated woodpecker is, look up Woody the Woodpecker. That's the cartoon this bird is depicted after. Giant woodpecker, it's crazy big in size. It's probably my favorite bird I've seen in Oregon so far. So I'm hearing this drumming and I'm like, wow, this is a really, really hungry woodpecker. And so I look up like, why am I hearing all this drumming now? And I came to understanding that the drumming you hear this time of year is actually the pileated males and females trying to stick out to try and find mates, which I thought was very interesting.
Is the woodpecker your favorite bird? Or if not, what is your favorite bird?
I'd say the woodpecker is my favorite bird in Oregon, but my favorite bird right now, or just all time, is probably the motmot.
And what's the most challenging aspect of your job?
Most challenging aspect of my job, I would say, is I want ACCF, Alder Creek Community Forest, to do well. I really appreciate their mission and what they're trying to do for community. And I want to try and put them in a position so that they continue doing this. So I'd say that making sure I'm doing what I have to do on a day-to-day basis put the site in a direction for success. And I am not the most experienced in this field, so it's a lot of contemplation, a lot of thinking, a lot of second guessing myself. And yeah, so it's just hoping I'm doing right by the site.
I also understand that Alder Creek is kind of remote in a way. Is it challenging getting people out there to help out or to see the site?
Yeah, we're a bit remote. We're out in Canyonville, Riddle area. Another problem we face is that the site has been offline for the past year and a half, 2 years due to COVID. So we are just starting to bring people back into site and trying to get our foothold back on the community again. And we're trying to regrow our relationship with the community and get people out there and show them what we have to offer.
I know that you are fairly new to the Alder Creek team. What do you hope to do in the future?
In the future with Alder Creek or in the future in general with myself?
Why don't we start with Alder Creek and then you can describe what you'd like to do in general?
So one of the things I'd like to do with Alder Creek, I want to try and bring in interesting people to help with educational days. I'd like to bring in experts on different environmental aspects to lead discussions and nature hikes or projects that we can lead the community on. We've had a local botanist come and lead an educational hike. Hopefully in April, we'll have a mycologist come out and lead a hike. I think it would be really cool giving people an opportunity to see experts in their field. And yeah, I just think that's a cool area we can help establish.
So this radio show might actually be a good way to get some interesting listeners involved in your work. How might listeners get involved? How can volunteers get in contact with you?
Yeah, so I think a great way would be to contact myself personally, the email I gave before.
And that was DannyKalki31@gmail.com. You mentioned earlier that your favorite bird was the motmot. I don't think I've ever heard of that bird. It sounds rather exotic. Where did you first find out about this bird?
I first found out about this bird while I was working abroad in Costa Rica as a research assistant. Yeah, and it was just caught my ear and caught my eye while I was there.
Well, that's very interesting. You were a research assistant in Costa Rica. How did you get there and what were you researching?
So like I've said before, I wanted to get into energy policy, environmental policy, stuff like that. One of my beliefs are, I think if I want to have any say or influence on policies like this going forward, I should have some semblance of an understanding of the conservation and research that is happening. And so I applied to these positions and I got one in Costa Rica. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go work in Costa Rica for a while. So that's what I did.
Do you have any interesting experiences that you'd like to share about your time in Costa Rica?
Oh, yeah, do I? So I was working at the Cloudbridge Nature Reserve, which is located in San Gerardo de Vivas in the San Jose province. The interesting part about this site, it's way up a mountain past a very small village. And the reason this site was so cool was its environment and where it's located. I think it was purchased or it was developed into a nature reserve back in the early 2000s, late 90s from a cattle farm. And what transpired past that purchase really led to a lot of cool stuff going forward. So there are currently three different parts for the nature reserve environmentally right now. We have the old growth forests, which is these massive trees that have never been cut down. Thick foliage, thick underbrush, everything. And the second form, it would be the natural regrowth, which is where the trees that have been growing for 20 years naturally are starting to come in. It's not as thick, the trees aren't as big, but it's getting there. And the third part is very similar to natural regrowth. The only difference is that it is human-assisted regrowth, is where people have gone in and planted native plants to help assist. Very similar to natural regrowth, pretty much identical. It's just has been helped by humans. And the reason this is really cool is researchers will go there and do studies on the variance of species and such within these three environments. Pretty cool setup there from that aspect. And one of the researchers was helping out there, was trying to contribute to a study on the effect of human interaction with species in the reserve. How much impact, if impact at all, humans being on site had on seeing different species there. So one of the ways he would test this, we would go on point counts of all species, not just birds. Go walk the trails, and every time we would see something fauna-based, you'd mark it down. And these surveys weren't always as quiet. We would talk, we wouldn't be silent because we were trying to reflect the impact of hikers and people like that. So I remember one of these surveys, there were about five of us, a pretty big group for a survey. And we were hiking back along the edge of natural regrowth and old regrowth. And we've been hiking for a while. We had seen some turkey vultures, some other cool birds. And we started to hear the screeches of spider monkeys, which is really cool. A few of us hadn't seen spider monkeys yet. So obviously we all get really quiet and we can hear them down the mountain, like breaking trees and just like infighting and stuff like that. So we're all trying to peek through the bamboo and the foliage and trying to see what's down there. And we keep moving, get real quiet, and the shrieks and the screams eventually die out. We're disappointed. And this is when I remember, like maybe shortly after this, one of the fellow research assistants goes, I think I see something in the tree over there. It's green. And then the researcher who was doing the project goes, all right, let me see. And he pulls down his binoculars and his face is just, it was like a kid on Christmas. The amount of happiness and glee on his face, he was about to break into tears. And we're like, well, what is it? What do you see? And he's like, it's a quetzal. It's a resplendent quetzal. And I look at him and I go, I don't know what that is. I have no idea what you're talking about. And he goes, look. And I look through the binoculars and it's a bird. And I'll say, it was a beautiful, beautiful bird. But to me, it was a bird. And that's cool. But to him, it was something so much more. And I really appreciated that. I thought that was really cool. I think it was awesome seeing someone who was so passionate about a field be so fulfilled by something that I didn't understand, but I could appreciate. And I think that's something I want to replicate at Alder Creek. I think bringing in individuals of expertise in different environmental fields and sharing their passion with the community can be a great driving point for exposure into these topics and hopefully jumpstart some individuals to develop and explore passions of their own.
So in Costa Rica, what would you say is the general relationship that people there have with the natural environment that you've noticed?
So I will say I was in a bit of a bubble being up in a research facility past the mountain, but I think Costa Rica as a whole has a pretty solid relationship with its environment. I think from person to person, they have a better understanding of the impact they have on their environment and vice versa, what the environment has an impact on them. And I think that's that understanding and that development of respect that has led to such policies that Costa Rica has developed towards clean energy.
Well, thank you so much, Danny, for sharing all of your experiences in Costa Rica at Alder Creek and during your college years. Do you have any closing thoughts before we finish up?
Yeah, I guess I'll say one last note on the concept of like my thoughts on like energy policy and sustainable systems. I think the global environment that we share, it's going to keep deteriorating so long as traditional energy systems are the status quo. This is a global security risk. This is everyone's problem. We're in this together and we got to figure it out. To combat growing energy demand, we got to diversify energy sources and relieve negative environmental impacts. We have to find what sustainability means and push policy to implement that. And like I said before, best way to do that is to push locally and get policy going. Yeah, we just got to address this going forward.
Well, once again, thank you so much for your thoughts, and thank you as well for appearing on Living Downstream.
It's been my pleasure, Viviana. Thank you for having me.